This is a Bleacher Bunch production for the Fans First Sports Network. Please check out our other shows as well, Cubba Cubby Blue, Cubs PS Plus, and The Sun Ranto Show.
Play ball.
Round the internet we go, where we end up no one knows. Sit back and enjoy the show. Down the baseball rabbit hole, down the baseball rabbit hole.
Welcome to the sixth inning of the Baseball Rabbit Hole, the baseball podcast where I look up something about baseball and follow the rabbit hole that it opens up. I don't know when you were listening to this podcast, but for me, it is spring 2021. This is the season that I decided to chronicle every game for the Chicago Cubs with poems. While this may seem odd to many of you, poems about baseball have been around since baseball began. This is probably because baseball began in an era of the printed word, where pictures were either hand-drawn or of such low quality that the only real way to see the game was to be there or to create it in your mind. Writers worked very hard to bring the game alive for their readers in any way that they could, and poems were great for this purpose. With this, they inadvertently created the romance of the game. The reason we are all so tied to this sport could very well be that these poems did not report about the game so much as they created it whole cloth out of the imaginations of the readers. Henry Chadwick, who you might remember from the first inning of this podcast, created the box score, which made it possible for people all over the country to quickly, easily, and analytically understand what was happening on the field. But it was the poet that illustrated how the game felt and how we felt about the game. Written by Ernest Thayer under the pen name Finn, that's spelled P-H-I-N, in 1888 and published in the Daily Examiner in San Francisco, Casey at the Bat is considered the most famous baseball poem in history. If you are listening to a baseball podcast, then you are probably aware that this poem exists. Even if you don't really know anything about baseball, you're probably aware that this poem exists. It is a part of the fabric of American sports. But if you're like me, I doubt that many of you have even read it or heard it. So let's fix that right now. I am going to read you Casey at the Bat. The outlook wasn't good for Mudville 9 that day. The score stood 4-2. With but one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first, and Barrows did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought if only Casey could get but a whack at that, they'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a Lulu and the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single, to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted, and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second, and Flynn a hugging third. Then from 5,000 throats and more, there rose a lusty yell. It rumbled through the valley. It rattled in the dell. It knocked upon the mountain and recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone on the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two!" "Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and echo answered fraud. But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. Yeah, that really is a great one. Thank you for indulging me in the reading of that. And now we've all heard it. I'm sure we've all known about this poem for a long time, but until I had started to do the research on this, I had never actually heard it or read through the whole thing. I'd only really read the last four lines, but the rest of the story had just been kind of told to me, you know, not the actual poem being read to me or me actually reading that poem. Anyway, the poem was one of many humorous poems Thayer had written for the Daily Examiner over the years and was of no specific importance to its author or to the paper itself. The paper needed entertaining content, and Casey at the Bat was just filling that spot in the paper. It would possibly have died with the June 3rd edition of the paper, except that it struck the eye of Archibald Clavering Gunter, who cut it out and kept it. Gunter just happened to be good friends with an up-and-coming Broadway star named William DeWolf Hopper. Hopper was a huge baseball fan and had persuaded the owner of the opera company to take the company out to see the Chicago White Stockings play the New York Giants over at the Polo Grounds. In addition to just going out to the game, Colonel McCall, the owner of the company, invited the ballplayers to the show after the game. Both teams accepted the offer. Hopper had wanted to do something special for the ballplayers, and his buddy Archibald Gunter suggested Casey at the Bat and gave his friend the poem clipping that he still had in his wallet. Hopper loved the poem and decided it was just the thing to recite for the two teams. The day that the McCall Opera Company went out to the game, the White Stockings had won 4-2, which just happened to be the exact score from the poem. The stars were aligning as Hopper took to the stage and performed Casey at the Bat for the first time. The crowd, buoyed by the presence of the Giants and the White Stockings, went absolutely wild for the poem. A review was published in the New York World the next day, which described the scene: "Men got up on their seats and cheered. It was one of the wildest scenes ever seen in a theater." William DeWolf Hopper, already well known, became a star because of his renditions of Casey at the Bat, and him doing that poem became a staple of his career and he performed it over 10,000 times throughout the rest of his life. Adding to the hype of the poem and the performance was a mystery at the center of it all. Nobody knew who had written the poem. If you remember, Thayer had signed it with his pen name, Finn. It was several years before Thayer actually claimed the poem. This led to the poem being attributed to other authors and then to an investigation that ultimately led to Thayer getting the credit he deserved. Now, between the humor of the poem, the theatrical performances, the mysterious origins, and fan theories about who Casey was in real life, Casey at the Bat grew to become omnipresent in our culture. The haughty hero that fails, the wild, angry crowds cheering, and the sports comeback that falls just short were all packaged into this short poem that has lent itself to every aspect of popular culture, from movies to comic books to songs and even video games. I mean, like I said right up at the top, you may not have ever heard Casey at the Bat, but you knew exactly what it was. Talking about Casey or Casey at the Bat is no longer a reference to a poem, but a reference to a reference to a reference about failure. It is the essence of a sport in which even the greatest players fail a majority of the time. And in that, it is a metaphor for life itself, in which we all play the game knowing that the best we can do is try to fail just a little less than those who came before us. And ultimately, our end is all the same. We will strike out and head back to the dugout, whatever you may believe that to be. And although the poem was written almost a century and a half ago, it still paints a romantic picture of that thin line between victory and defeat, hope and despair. And to be honest, just looking at it from the aspect of baseball, is there any poem, or any writing really, that is more relevant to 21st century baseball than a power hitter striking out? And with that, we will let old Casey hit the showers. And when I come back, I will tell you about what is considered to be the second most famous baseball poem ever written, because even in poetry, batting always seems to get more attention than defense. Hey, this is a part of the show where I would normally tell you, go to my Patreon and support the show. But here's the thing. I screwed up the Patreon one time, so I went back to do it again. And when I was doing it, I thought to myself, I really shouldn't be doing a Patreon because I don't put these shows out very often. And it really just doesn't seem to make sense. So if you really want to support the show monetarily, hit me up on PayPal or Venmo at mcotton2019. That's the same for both of them. And you can give me money there if you'd like. Otherwise, if you really want to do something Patreon style, go to Patreon for Sonranto, Sonranto. And that's where I do my other podcast. You can give money there, and that would also support what I do. Thank you. Now back down the rabbit hole. While this next poem was written a little over two decades after, its origins are somewhat the same as Casey at the Bat. It was a poem written for a humor column in a newspaper, the New York Evening Mail, and nobody really expected it to be a big deal. Franklin Adams wrote a daily column for the newspaper called Always in Good Humor, and his editor had informed him that he needed eight more lines to fill his upcoming column. On this particular day, Adams was bailing from work early to go see a baseball game. So, as Adams rode the bus to the game, he contemplated the eight lines he needed. Now, let me explain something here for those of you who may not understand what I mean when I talk about filling up space for the papers. Newspapers were actual physical bunches of paper with stories, advertising, and pictures on them. Each page had a specific amount of room to print these stories, advertising, and pictures, which meant that the editors and writers would have to plan out how many words and how many lines they needed in each column before the paper could be printed. Because if you didn't, there would be large open spaces of nothing. So Adams had 8 lines to fill. And so he wrote a poem about his favorite team, the Chicago Cubs. Now, he lived and worked in New York, and he knew a poem about the Cubs wouldn't be well received because the Cubs and Giants were bitter rivals at the time. So he wrote the poem from the perspective of a Giants fan, lamenting the brilliance of the Cubs' infield so that his readers didn't feel like he was just cheering on the Cubs. By the time he got off the bus, he'd finished his poem so he could now enjoy the game. Here is what he wrote. These are the saddest of possible words. Tinker to Evers to Chance. Trio of bear cubs and fleeter than birds. Tinker and Evers and Chance. Ruthlessly pricking our gonfalon bubble. Making a giant hit into a double. Words that are heavy with nothing but trouble. Tinker to Evers to Chance. He turned it into the editor, originally titled That Double Play Again. And his editor didn't think it was all that great, but it did fill the space that was needed. So it was published on July 12, 1910 in the New York Evening Mail. They probably assumed that would be the end of it. Then the Chicago Daily Tribune reprinted the poem as Gotham's Woe on July 15th. On the 18th, the New York Evening Mail took it back and reprinted the poem under its final name, Baseball's Sad Lexicon. The poem sparked a back and forth between New York writers and Chicago writers who wrote multiple poems for their respective newspapers. The poems either added to the poem directly and or added responses, or were just in the same style but illustrating different plays in baseball that year. This was the 1910 equivalent of going viral, or I guess writing a diss track. The poems themselves have been somewhat lost to the public. They exist only in the files of the New York Public Library and the Center for Research Libraries, where it takes some considerable effort to be allowed to look through the old microfiche files. Anyway, back to the original. While Casey at the Bat is inarguably the most famous baseball poem, Baseball's Sad Lexicon could be the most influential baseball poem. It made Tinker, Evers, and Chance a household name. I mean, just from that poem, they became the most famous double play combination in the history of the game. The problem is, they were never actually the best double play combination in the history of the game, despite being the most famous. In 1910, the Cubs were 5th out of 8 teams in double plays turned. In the years from 1906 to 1910, when the Cubs won 4 out of 5 pennants and 2 World Series championships, they were never the best at turning double plays. In the years after, they did turn more double plays than they'd ever done before, but they still never led the league in any one season. Individually, none of the named players truly had the numbers to get into the Baseball Hall of Fame. They were excellent defenders, but they never even led the league in the thing that they were most known for, and none of them distinguished themselves at the plate. Frank Chance is possibly the most deserving of the three as a manager because he managed the team through the great stretch from 06 to 10, and was able to keep Tinker and Evers from killing each other during that time, which was quite a feat in itself. But ultimately, his prowess as an actual player does not make the strongest argument. None of the three made the Hall of Fame when they were first eligible. Chance died in 1924, and both Tinker and Evers were so ill in 1946 that they could not attend the Hall of Fame ceremony when they eventually did get in. The poem had a life of its own, and within that life, the prowess of these Cubs was heightened. It was the power of this poem, the romance of games long gone, and the chance to honor some ill ball players with famous names that led the Old Timers Committee to induct all three together. Bill James would write in his 1994 book, Whatever Happened to the Hall of Fame, that with the induction of these three men together, quote, "The argument that the Hall of Fame should be only for the greatest of the great was irretrievably lost," unquote. Outside of the mathematicians and people like me following rabbit holes that lead to unsatisfying stories, the only thing anyone really remembers is that Tinker to Evers to Chance were part of the greatest double play combination in the history of the game, whether that's true or not. Without Franklin Pierce Adams and the poem Baseball's Sad Lexicon, the Hall of Fame would be three Cubs less, which would have been fine. But what we have is so much better. It is life imitating art, and art getting a second life. Because of the poem, we will never forget Tinker, Evers, or Chance. And because of the Hall of Fame, we will never forget Baseball's Sad Lexicon. And when I come back, I'm going to finish off the podcast with a poem that some may know, but definitely does not get the fame of the other two, although I believe it really should. The first two poems I looked at are the two most famous. They were a product of their times. Back at the turn of the 20th century, poetry was more prevalent, and because the written word was one of the major forms of entertainment, carried much more weight than it does now. Although I will say that there are still great contemporary poems being written, and you should all either search them out or maybe even write some for yourself. This last poem, though, is less remembered, as it was part of a television broadcast back in 1989 and never immortalized on the page, as far as I know. Also, the poet is known as a baseball broadcaster rather than a poet, although I would say nobody has ever created more poetry about the game over the last 70-plus years.
Hey!
The poet I am talking about is, of course, Vin Scully, the voice of the Brooklyn and Los Angeles Dodgers for 67 seasons. You could argue that the sultry tones of baseball's greatest voice created poetry each and every game. They just called it play-by-play instead of poetry. But in 1989, Vin Scully wrote an opening for the NLCS in which the Chicago Cubs were hosting the San Francisco Giants at Wrigley Field in the 75th year of Wrigley's existence. Now, this piece was never intended to be poetry, but when I read it for you, I think you're going to agree that there's nothing else to call it. And even more interestingly, Vin Scully wasn't even at the game when they played this. He was a part of the national team broadcasting the playoffs, but before the second game of the series, Vin Scully woke up sick and was not on the broadcast. Regardless, Vin's voice greeted the television viewers before the game with an ode to Wrigley Field. Now, Wrigley Field is not just a ballpark. It's a connection to the past. And Vin Scully gave us a poem that not only celebrated everything Wrigley ever was, but gave Cubs and Cubs fans hope for the future, while also honoring a past that, let's face it, wasn't always that great for Cubs. Vin's poem is a wonderful celebration of what Wrigley Field means to Cubs fans, what baseball means to all baseball fans, and really what life itself means as we grow older. It is an ode to persevering through tough times with hope that it will all come out okay. As far as I know, this is untitled and unpublished, outside of that one broadcast back in 1989. You can find it on YouTube now, and I suggest that you go and check it out. For now, you'll just have to listen to my voice instead of Vin's, but I hope that I can do it some sort of justice. She stands alone on the corner of Clark and Addison, this dowager queen dressed in black and pearls, 75 years old, proud head held high, and not a hair out of place, awaiting yet another date with destiny, another time for Mr. Right. She dreams, as old ladies will, of men long ago, Joe Tinker, Johnny Evers, Frank Chance, and those of recent vintage, like her man Ernie, and the Lion, and sweet Billy Williams. And she thinks wistfully of what might have been, and the pain is still fresh and new. and her eyes fill, her lips tremble, and she shakes her head ever so slightly. And then she sighs, pulls her shawl tightly around her frail shoulders, and thinks, this time it will be better. The Cubs went on to beat the Giants that night, but it did not get better because that was the only game they won in that series, and it would continue to not get better. Over the next 27 years, the Cubs would try and fail 4 different times to try and reach the World Series again. In fact, it wasn't until 2016, against Vin Scully's very own Dodgers, when Kyle Hendricks would finally send the Cubs back to the World Series for the first time since 1945, when a goat named Murphy got kicked out of Wrigley Field. But that is a story for a different baseball rabbit hole. Vin Scully's poem, I mean, if you remove the specific references to Wrigley Field and the Cubs, I mean, this is what it means to be a fan of baseball, or really to just be human. Time marches on for all of us, but each day we get up and we move forward, as if it were spring training once again, and we had the whole season ahead of us. And if we're lucky, it will be better. The recaps and the numbers and even the final outcomes of games or seasons or careers are great as a framework to think about the past and baseball. But I believe it's the artistry that we see out on the field from the players themselves and the art that we get surrounding the game that is truly what connects us to baseball. And that is going to be it for me in this inning. I hope you enjoyed this inning of the baseball rabbit hole. And until next time, keep rounding those bases.
You're out!
This episode of the Baseball Rabbit Hole was written by Michael Cotton, produced by Michael Cotton, edited by Michael Cotton, recorded by Michael Cotton, all on Audacity. The only thing I don't do is the theme song. That is by the incomparable Danny Rocket. Take it away, Danny.
Round the internet we go, where we end up no one knows. Sit back and enjoy the show. Down the baseball rabbit hole, down the baseball rabbit hole.